The Art of the Deal by Donald Trump. So let's go into a little bit of Donald Trump's deal-making processes, his mentality on making deals, and the tools and tricks and methods he believes at least have been successful in his life as far as making deals is concerned. He starts the book off with a little explanation on why he does what he does. "I don't do it for the money. I've got enough. Much more than I'll ever need. I do it to do it. Deals are my art form. Other people paint beautifully on a canvas or write wonderful poetry. I like making deals. Preferably big deals. That's how I get my kicks. Most people are surprised by the way I work. I play it very loose. I don't carry a briefcase. I try not to schedule too many meetings. I leave my door open. You can't be imaginative or entrepreneurial if you've got too much structure. I prefer to come to work each day and just see what develops." Well, I can guarantee he doesn't have that luxury anymore. He probably has a very rigid schedule that's probably killing him right now. "My style of deal making is quite simple and straightforward. I aim very high, and then I just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing to get what I'm after. Sometimes I settle for less than I sought, but in most cases, I still end up with what I want." And you'll see how he sets the stage with this, with a lot of his rhetoric, especially during the campaign. And he'll explain it later on some of his techniques or methods to the art of making a deal. And you've seen that with the legals, with every subject. He started off very bombastic and walked back a bit, but gets the other side to go more closer to him just because he starts off so wild. Like NATO, what he's doing with NATO is a great example of it. But anyways, let's go on. "More than anything else, I think deal-making is an ability you're born with. It's in the genes. I don't say that egotistically. It's not about being brilliant. It does take a certain intelligence, but mostly it's about instincts. You can take the smartest kid at Wharton, the one who gets straight A's and has the 170 IQ, and if he doesn't have the instincts, he will never be a successful entrepreneur." So you do kind of have to be born with it. I think we see this in other aspects of life too. All right, so now let's get into his tools to making the deal. First, think big. "I like thinking big. I always have. To me, it's very simple. If you're going to be thinking anyways, you might as well think big. Most people think small because people are afraid of success, afraid of making decisions, afraid of winning. And that gives people like me a great advantage." There's a lot of truth to that. I think most of us can fall into that category, whether we realize it or not. Because a part of winning is being focused and doing and disciplined. And a lot of us are just simply afraid or too comfortable in our current situations to want to dedicate that much time and effort and passion and focus on something. But that's what it takes to win. One of the keys to thinking big is total focus. I think of it almost as a controlled neurosis, which is a quality I've noticed in many highly successful entrepreneurs. They're obsessive, they're driven, they're single-minded, and sometimes they're almost maniacal. But it's all channeled into their work. Where other people are paralyzed by neurosis, the people I'm talking about are actually helped by it. I don't say this trait leads to a happier life or a better life, but it's great when it comes to getting what you want. This is particularly true in New York real estate, where you are dealing with some of the sharpest, toughest, and most vicious people in the world. I happen to love to go up against these guys, and I love to beat them. So think big. And what is thinking bigger than saying, hey, I'm gonna become the president? No one in my position has ever won the presidency before or even been taken as a serious contender, but I'm going to win the presidency. And not only that, I'm going to say I'm going to win from day one. And I'm going to continue to say it all the way up until I win. And that's what he did. That's thinking big. Next, he has protect the downside and the upside will take care of itself. It's been said that I believe in the power of positive thinking. In fact, I believe in the power of negative thinking. I happen to be very conservative in business. I always go into the deal anticipating the worst. If you plan for the worst, if you can live with the worst, the good will always take care of itself. So that's kind of like expect the worst, but hope for the best. It's that kind of mentality. So he's going into these deals. He's already mentally had it happen that the worst case scenario, he's envisioned it, thought about how he would feel, how it would impact him. And he's gone through that whole thought process. So he's already dulled himself to it if it actually happens, because he's kind of already experienced it in a way. Hope for the best, but expect the worst. Next, maximize your options. I also protect myself by being flexible. I never get too attached to one deal or one approach. For starters, I keep a lot of balls in the air because most deals fall out, no matter how promising they seem at first. In addition, once I've made a deal, I always come up with at least a half a dozen approaches to making it work, because anything can happen, even to the best laid plans. So maximizing your options, he's going to have to do a lot of that in Washington. He's definitely going to have to maximize his options, because no deals will be made easily in Washington when you have so much partisanship and so much special interest and all the things that go on in D.C. Next, know your market. Some people have a great sense of the market. Some people don't. I like to think I have instinct. That's why I don't hire a lot of number crunchers, and I don't trust fancy marketing surveys. I do my own surveys, and I draw my own conclusions. I'm a great believer in asking everyone for an opinion before I make a decision. It's a natural reflex. If I'm thinking about buying a piece of property, I'll ask the people who live nearby about the area, what they think of the schools and the crime and the shops. When I'm in another city and I take a cab, I'll always make a point to ask the cab driver questions. I ask and I ask and I ask until I begin to get a gut feeling about something. And that's when I make a decision. So he definitely did this during the campaign. He knew his market. This market that was ignored and avoided by the Republicans for a long time and the Democrats as well. And that was the quote unquote silent majority, the working class, the largely white working class who were completely ignored, forgotten about, and just expected to take the brunt of everything on their back. It's you're going to work to pay the taxes to support the lowest rung on the ladder. And the politicians and the businesses and the corporations you work for are going to enhance the highest rung of the ladders. And for the longest time, these people had no voice. And Trump spoke directly to that. He went directly to that. So he knew his market. He knew there was a group of people out there that were completely ignored that he can seize up right away. And he did right away. If you notice, he automatically had a passionate following, like right away, within his first month or two of announcing and then going out on the campaign and getting his ideas out there. And then that passionate group stuck with him all the way to the end, up until the point where the Republicans had to concede and all go to vote for him, and some independents had to concede and go vote for him as opposed to Hillary Clinton. That passionate group, that his market that he was targeting to this day, even if some of them are a little frustrated about what's going on, still passionately with him. So he knew his market. He went out there and got it. Next is use your leverage. The worst thing you can possibly do in a deal is seem desperate to make it. That makes the other guy smell blood and then you're dead. The best thing you can do is deal from strength, and leverage is the biggest strength you can have. Leverage is having something the other guy wants, or better yet, needs, or the best of all, simply can't do without. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case, which is why leverage often requires imagination and salesmanship. In other words, you have to convince the other guy it's in his interest to make the deal. Now, with NATO during the campaign, and even now, he uses this leverage of American money and American might to help pressure other members of NATO to pay their bills. The threat of pulling that out. And, of course, our media didn't help him, right? The left didn't help him. Even the fucking Republicans didn't help him when he was trying to use this leverage to get a better deal for Americans so we could pay less into this. None of them helped him, but he still used that leverage, and he's still going to get them to pay up without the... And then all the Republicans and all the cucks are going to all be happy about it and say, hey, isn't this great, when they were all against it, and they all did their best to sabotage him when he was trying to use that leverage to make a better deal. Enhance your location. That's the next one. Perhaps the most misunderstood concept in all of real estate is that the key to success is location, location, location. Usually, that is said by the people who don't know what they're talking about. First of all, you don't necessarily need the best location. What you need is the best deal. Just as you can leverage, you can enhance a location through promotion and through psychology. Location has a lot to do with fashion. You can take a mediocre location and turn it into something considerably better just by attracting the right people. My point is that the real money isn't made in real estate by spending top dollar on the best location. You can get killed doing that, as you can get killed buying a bad location for a very low price. What you should never do is pay too much, even if that means walking away from a very good site, which is all a more sophisticated way of looking at location. And of course, you see Trump always enhances location whenever he's talking about one of his buildings. And he also enhances people, like himself. Like, he always says, I'm the best. I love women the most. You know, oh, I love this the most. Oh, my people are the best. And always, or this reporter is the best. This guy's the best. Oh, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. And he always says, oh, Comey's doing a great job. Oh, Comey's fired now. Right, and the media's like, oh, he said he was doing a great job. It's like that, once again, it's another psychological tool. You don't, it's like when the media jumped on Trump for not sticking with China is a currency manipulator, just as he's about to deal with China. And it's like, well, what kind of fucking logic is that? How am I going to insult the person I'm trying to make better deals with that benefit our country? And then lo and behold, it comes out, yes, there was deals made, and it is actually advantageous to American workers and farmers and cattlers and et cetera, et cetera. And that's by talking up these people, enhancing their location essentially as people. And so it's another method, and it's something the media probably knows better. They're probably just malicious. You always wonder which of these people are ignorant and which are actually being malicious. They're probably malicious. But this is how he gets things done. This is how he speaks. This is how he makes his deals. And he tells you. He flat out tells you he does. Okay, next is get the word out. You can have the most wonderful product in the world, but if people don't know about it, it's not going to be worth much. You need to generate interest, and you need to create excitement. One way is to hire public relations people and pay them a lot of money to sell whatever you got. But to me, that's like hiring outside consultants to study a market. It's never as good as doing it yourself. And that's just like they ignored all the polls. And like they said, their internal polls were showing something very different during the campaign. One thing I learned about the press is that they're always hungry for a good story. And the more sensational, the better. It's the nature of the job, and I understand that. The point is that if you are a little different or a little outrageous, or if you do things that are bold or cause controversy, the press is going to write about you. I've always done things a little differently. I don't mind controversy, and my deals tend to be somewhat ambitious. Also, I achieved a lot when I was very young, and I choose to live a certain lifestyle. The result is that the press has always wanted to write about me. I'm not saying that they necessarily like me. Sometimes they write positively, and sometimes they write negatively. But from a pure business point of view, the benefits of being written about have far outweighed the drawbacks. Look, he just got them eating out of his hand. Eating out of his hand. He did that to perfection. They played every one of his campaign rallies on television. Every one of them. And he did a lot of them. Where is there anyone in history that had that many televised campaign speeches to the whole world over and over again? And it didn't matter what the fake news said after. They got to get the right from the source for a good hour before fake news came in and started narrating, you know, how what was so bad about it, and et cetera, et cetera. And he did that by being bombastic, by causing controversy. Just like he knew here when he wrote The Art of the Deal. I believe this was in the late 80s, early 90s he wrote this. And he goes on, "The final key to the way I promote is bravado. I play to people's fantasies. People may not always think big themselves, but they can still get very excited by those that do. Make America great again." That's why a little hyperbole never hurts. People want to believe in something that is the biggest and greatest and most spectacular. I call it truthful hyperbole. It's an innocent form of exaggeration and a very effective form of promotion. Fight back. His next tool is fight back. Much as it pays to emphasize the positive, there are times when the only choice is confrontation. In most cases, I am very easy to get along with. I'm very good to people who are good to me. But when people treat me badly or unfairly or try to take advantage of me, my general attitude all my life has been to fight back very hard. And we see he definitely lived by that, more so on the campaign than today, but still to this day.
Most kids between the ages of 6 and 16 have been bullied at some point in their lives. Were you ever bullied?
No, I wasn't. But I have seen bullying, and bullying doesn't have to just be as a child. I mean, I know people are bullied when they're 55 years old.
It can happen when you're 45.
It's you know, it happens, right? But you got to get over it. Fight back, do whatever you have to do. I've been saying during this whole campaign that I'm a counterpuncher. You understand that. I'm responding. Now, I then respond times maybe 10. I don't know. I mean, I respond pretty strongly. But in just about all cases, I've been responding to what they did to me.
Constantly fighting back against fake news. The risk is that you'll make a bad situation worse. And I certainly don't recommend this approach to everyone. But my experience is that if you're fighting for something you believe in, even if it means alienating some people along the way, things usually work out for the best in the end. Even if I never went on the offensive, there are a lot of people gunning for me now. One of the problems when you have become successful is that jealousy and envy inevitably follow. There are people, I categorize them as life's losers, who get their sense of accomplishment and achievement from trying to stop others. As far as I'm concerned, if they had any real ability, they wouldn't be fighting me. They'd be doing something constructive themselves. I mean, that's basically your democratic protesters, right, today. And just like how his people keep trying to get him off Twitter, even back in before Twitter, he says, "My people keep telling me that I shouldn't write to the critics. The way I see it, critics get to say what they want to about my work, so why shouldn't I be able to say what I want to about theirs?" Next, deliver the goods. You can't con people, at least not for long. You can create excitement. You can do a wonderful promotion, and you can get all kinds of press. And you can throw in a little hyperbole. But if you don't deliver the goods, people will eventually catch on. And that's what he has to do now, is deliver the goods. And I think he wants to. I don't think he fully understood what he was getting into when he got into it, what the system consists of, and why it's, at least how it is set up today, almost impossible for one man to do anything about it. But he's still desperately going to try to get some victories on certain things, if not only to get reelected, to save his reputation and his legacy. Because I'm firmly convinced his legacy matters to him. And being a weak president wouldn't sit well with him. Next, contain the costs. I believe in spending what you have to, but I also believe in not spending more than you should. I learned from my father that every penny counts, because before too long your pennies turn into dollars. The point is that you can dream great dreams, but they'll never amount to much if you can't turn them into reality at a reasonable cost. And we've seen that already, about how much the airplanes cost and numerous other things. He's always getting the better cost. He's trying to contain the cost. And lastly, he says, have fun. I don't kid myself. Life is very fragile, and success doesn't change that. If anything, success makes it more fragile. Anything can change without warning. And that's why I try not to take any of what's happened too seriously. Money was never a big motivation for me, except as a way to keep score. The real excitement is playing the game. So that's Trump's art of the deal. I think he lives it to a T. We could see, and everything he's done today, and this was 30 years ago he wrote this book, all the methods he used during the campaign and even to this day, you see his mentality. It is what it is. He is who he says he is, essentially. He applied these methods that he used to make deals to politics, and it worked out great for him, despite the controversy, despite the hate, despite being one of the most unpopular, polled people and running for an office. He still won. And if he can come through at least half of his promises, he's going to win again. And you can bet your bottom dollar the same techniques he spoke about in The Art of the Deal, the same techniques he used during the first campaign, you'll see them all over again during the second campaign. And they'll work again. And once again, the media will go out of their way. And because why? They're just the extension of international finance in the end. They'll go out of their way to take everything literal and get the emotional reactionaries to go right along with that. So I don't know if his bombastic style is for everybody, but it was definitely for him. And it definitely worked for him and continues to still do so even to this day.